This is Ridgely Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A $40 million project that brings more technology to Northwest Indiana is open for business. Digital Crossroad is located on Hammond's Lake Michigan shoreline, a million-plus square-foot campus with plenty of room for expansion beyond just the data center. Tom Dokich is the man who envisioned the project, and he sat down with us yesterday to talk about it. And here's our conversation.
First of all, I'm thrilled to be here. You guys are a staple of what goes on here and in information that flies through you. I'm thrilled to be talking to you about this at this stage. Last time we talked was probably 8 months ago, maybe a while ago.
Yeah.
And we were still in the planning stage. We were still moving through it. Mm-hmm. But I'm proud to say that the vision of a whole bunch of people, the mayor of Hammond, Tom McDermott, and Governor Holcomb, a bunch of legislators, Ed Soliday, and now Frank Mervan, all these people have come, is about to result in a data center being opened very, very soon at Hammond. Mm-hmm. Our project is 105,000 square feet, and which is not a huge data center by national standards, but it makes us as big and as competitive as anything that's going on in Indiana, and it also enters us into the Chicago market. Mm-hmm. We have 12 megawatts of power going in there, which is a fantastic amount of power in the that NIPSCO has been a great partner with us for, and it's going to be able to serve. We'll be able to serve the largest companies in the world who can come to our data center and spend and put their servers and racks in.
Mm-hmm. When the project was first conceived, when you and all the other people involved in this came up with this, I'm sure that probably finding a way to get Northwest Indiana better connected into the cloud, since that's what a data center basically does, it kind of turns into like the local version of the cloud, although for lots of people, it doesn't have to be just local, it could be anyone. But the idea is that it helps provide the wherewithal so that not only national organizations, if they choose, but local ones can take advantage of this extra computing power that this service can provide, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The amount of fiber, if you look at a map of the United States, fiber goes under rail. And the only natural barrier to rail is Lake Michigan. So it mm-hmm. accumulates right down the street in Northwest Indiana. There's a massive monorail where there's fiber underneath there, but nobody in Northwest Indiana was tapping into it. Very few people were using that. The city of Chesterton and Valparaiso, they have a local loop, but to attract national companies to do national things, there was no way to do it. So what we've done is we've created a fiber network using some rail. The people over at Norfolk Southern were nice enough to sell us some conduit, and we filled it up with a massive amount of rail. So think about it this way. Think about the rail started someplace else, and there were no off ramps. There was no usage. It wasn't benefiting us in Northwest Indiana in any meaningful way, because it would start over in Detroit and go to Chicago without any off ramps. So it's the same. It's the equivalent as saying, I'm going to get on I-65 in Gary, and the only time I can get off of I-65 is in Louisville, and there was no benefit to anybody in the state of Indiana the way it was before. What we've been able to do, we've been able to tap into the local, tap into this long haul, super expensive, super sophisticated fiber, and bring some local benefit to it by making it such that we have off ramps into Hammond to start.
Mm-hmm. I know that one of the keys, I guess, that the center provides, besides the connectivity, is data storage. And is that something that was one of the very first things that you all thought of and be able to create Digital Crossroad?
So we wanted to create a profitable, strong, vibrant, transformative company. We weren't looking to have something be ordinary or something be like anybody else. What we've done is made it such that in this, these large companies and local companies too, but primarily these large hyperscale companies who deliver the cloud to the world, they are able to use our facility in order to do data storage. Mm-hmm. The result should be, we think it is, and it's already started, we're at like 17 employees now, but the result should be that there's going to be a bunch of jobs created. People who are assisting in maintaining the cloud, people who are assisting in maintaining storage, those sorts of things. And we are, and you've hit it right, that this is where we are at. We're sitting on top of this massive amount of fiber that can be used to create the cloud, to create storage. That's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, describe the facility. We know that this is not a big facility physically, but there's a lot of things that are in this one space. I imagine that certainly the objective is to be able to set things up here. What was the situation like in creating this space out there along Lake Michigan?
This is my favorite part of it, because ComEd had the largest coal burning plant in the world at that location, and it was a mess. I mean, it was really, really toxic. A lot of that was going on. What happens is a guy named Simon Beamster-Bohr and Alan Beamster-Bohr were entrepreneurs. They saw that this was a great piece of land, so they cleaned it up. And the end result is that we're going to be able to use this to build a data center. Mm-hmm. This piece of land is uniquely interesting to the data center world, because the lake is so close, we can use it for cooling. The railroad is just far enough away to not cause a problem for from a safety perspective, but it's also close enough to way that we can interconnect into fiber that way. Mm-hmm. It's a great, great piece of land right on the Indiana-Illinois border. Governor Holcomb, the legislature, gave Tom McDermott and I this the right. He gave us some tax incentives for data centers, passed it in 2019, and it made a difference. National players are taking a look at us.
Now, the facility's up and running, or it technically is. It will be soon, I'm sure. You have the staff that's in there now with what you have. What are the plans, if you have the plans already in works for the future? Because you have this facility, and you can always bring more people and organizations in, can't you?
Yes, that's exactly right. So if we don't do anything else, we'll have built a mission-critical, independent, wholesale co-location data center in Hammond, Indiana. But that's not where we're stopping. We're building a tech incubator also there. We have the largest flagpole in Chicagoland that's there. We have a veterans park there. The unique properties of the air that comes out of servers has an inordinate amount of CO2 in it, which then creates growth in plants. So we're putting a greenhouse over there. We've got an alternative energy campus that's going in there. And oh, by the way, we have another 500,000 square feet of data center that we're hoping to put in there very soon.
Yeah. But there's plenty of room to work out there, and that's, I'm sure, one of the major reasons, aside from all the technical things you've mentioned, that attracted you in particular to the space. The old power plant could be easily torn down and turned into cleaner space, certainly, than it is now, or was back then, I should say, and it is now. And it's also a way to bring more economic development into the city of Hammond.
City of Hammond Economic Development Team, Africa Tarver, Ann Anderson, Phil Talon, have been fantastic. Mm-hmm. That what you just said is much better than I say it. They don't mess around. They basically, if they see an opportunity that they like, they go grab it. Our using only union jobs and local tradesmen and local subcontractors has paid off, and the economic boost to Hammond, I think the mayor's office would tell you it's been substantial.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about expansion in your conversations with Mayor McDermott and with his staff, in particular the economic development folks, have they mentioned any other organizations? I'm sure they're always working on something, but they probably are at some point where they're at least letting you know, hey, we've got some people that are interested in being in here. Can't mention who they are yet. They've got some things they have to be able to keep quiet until they make a move. But is there anything that you know of that the city is giving you kind of a clue about that they're going to be doing out there, besides what you were already doing out there at Digital Crossroad?
So we passed stuff back and forth, and with Mayor McDermott and with his staff, and things we talked to them about things we hear in the industry. They talk to us about what they hear. The Northwest Indiana Forum has been just been wonderful. Heather and her staff, Heather Ennis and her staff have been. They find things. The IEDC has been amazing. But yeah, Tom McDermott has so many things going on, and all these assets at his. So we pass stuff back and forth. They've been a great partner.
Now you're up here in the region on Monday. Make the trip up from Indianapolis to do some work up here as Digital Crossroad opens up. What do you get to be able to do now on these visits up here? Now that you've got offices that you can actually walk into and take up space now.
I see my mom more. My mom still likes to see me, anyways. But I'm up here all week, every week, my wife and kids are my wife's in Indianapolis, but my kids are stretched out a little bit. But I'm up here all week. I have a bunch of family up here. We bought a house up here. We bought a house in Munster. I just finished talking to the Valpo Rotary, and I was like, I feel like a cheerleader for Northwest Indiana because going back and forth to Indianapolis, I'm able to translate stuff a little bit. But I love Northwest Indiana. And Northwest Indiana is the best place in the world to live. I mean, we have such a good infrastructure. We have this gorgeous lake. We're not going to run out of water. We can get anywhere. We've got. It'd be nice if our airport were a little bit better. But it's a fantastic place to live.
Tom Dawkins, thank you for spending time with us talking about Digital Crossroad and about the great opportunities that your organization has been able to create up here in Hammond, and in turn how it's going to bring more great creations of other businesses to the region. Thank you very much.
It was fun to do. Thank you.
Next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Living in Valpo has been great. My kids were able to roam the city and skateboard and rollerblade, and they were active in school. So community-wise, it's been a real positive experience. I've lived downtown for probably 30 years, and I love it. I'm kind of on an island by myself here, so it's like I don't have, well, until now, I didn't have close neighbors. Everybody on this block is pretty quiet. You know, they kind of keep to themselves. You know, we say hi and things like that, but I don't think anybody interacts with each other that I know of. I think it's getting rich for my blood. I loved it when there were little shops downtown, and now it's all restaurants. And for the most part, I can't really afford those restaurants. You know, maybe the coffee shops or the sandwich shops, but to go out for dinner downtown, I can't afford that. I know that their idea is to have it a very community-based, you know, where lots of people from all over Valpo come downtown. And I think that's good. I mean, I love Central Park Plaza. It's just changed. A bigger town feeling than it used to be. When you have more wealthy residents moving into a neighborhood, I think there's going to be a difference. There's going to be a break between the neighborhood. Because, like, you know, you look around the street, you know, they're lower income, middle income, you know, hard working people. And then you've got a $600,000 house built next door, or down by Campbell, where they're going to build the townhouses that they say is affordable housing, but they're going to come in at $300,000 a unit. So it's not a conflict, and there's not especially hard feelings yet. But when the new development, the townhouses and this big house, they didn't think my backyard was good enough. And rather than coming to me to ask questions about my property, they went to the records and went to Project Neighbors, and I felt that was an invasion of privacy. You know, I'm not saying they're not nice, but I don't know how it will turn out. And basically, my feelings are it's people that have money versus somebody that doesn't have money. Respect, you know, I think that's the biggest thing. And the ability to get along, not be critical. I'm trying to think of the word and I can't think of it. I think people need to take care of their own property and their own house, but not be so concerned about what is across the street. Sometimes people can't do what other people can do. And I think that has to be taken into consideration.
You can find more original stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Gary International Film Festival is 10 years old this year, and they're going to launch it, obviously, because of the coronavirus pandemic in a different way, but there's still going to be a big celebration over 10 days. Let's find out more about this year's event. Karen Toering is the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival, and she is with us from her home, safe, we hope, and willing to talk about what's planned for the very, very important online event this year. Karen, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Hey there, Chris. Thank you.
Well, tell us the important things that folks should know about the fact that the International Black Film Festival is going to be online this year. And we all, of course, know the reasons why. But what kind of setups are there? And tell us what's all on the agenda for this year's event.
Well, yeah, the festival will be online this year. And you can go to GaryBlackFilmFest.org. And get the schedule and all of the events that are going to happen. And we're pretty excited. Normally, the festival is a weekend event. We usually start on Friday and end on Sunday. But because it's our 10th anniversary, we're going to go for 10 straight days, starting on November 10th and ending on November 20th. And yeah, we have an incredible lineup of films. The festival usually receives roughly 100 to 250 entries per year, depending on the year. But this year, Chris, we got 1,900 entries.
Oh, my goodness.
From around
oh.
the world.
Oh.
And six continents. So it's been a lot of work for the festival reviewers to sort through all of those films and come up with some gems. Folks. And we think people are going to like the lineup that we have.
That's great.
It's exciting because you get to watch at home, and you will be able to watch the films for 48 hours. So that's different. So when we publish the schedule, you can find the schedule online on Facebook or Instagram, or go to our website, GaryBlackFilmFest.org, and see the list of films. But once you sign up for a film or buy a ticket, you will be able to watch that film for the next 48 hours mm-hmm. at your leisure, in your jammies, or wherever, whatever you wear at home. I'm pretty much found in my jammies most of the time, except for the waist up, you know, for those Zoom meetings that we all have. And enjoy the film, and then we will have live talkbacks that are free with some of the films that you can watch either on YouTube or Facebook, or once again, you can go back to the website and watch those there.
I know you've got some great highlights of the events coming up here. The films are going to be shown during those 10 days. And it's a combination of, of narrative and documentaries and all kind of feature-length films and shorts and all that. And a few things you're bringing back, and one in particular that folks here in Northwest Indiana will definitely want to see if they've never seen it before, and that's Nation Time Gary. Tell us about how it's coming back.
Well, Nation Time Gary is about the 1972 Black political convention when 10,000 people came to Gary to set a new Black agenda. And the film is really interesting because it features some political figures that are here, that, you know, Jesse Jackson and Shirley Chisholm and Amiri Baraka and so many others who came to Gary, Indiana, to basically side a political agenda for Black people in 1972. And it's really reminiscent of the times that we are facing right now, mm-hmm. you know, with the current political climate and the Black Lives Matter movement being so very present in everyone's mind. So it's a look at the 1972 convention, which we feel like sort of gave birth to the movements that we see today. And we will have a special panel of folks who were actually there at the 1972 Black Convention. And that panel is going to be on here. I'm scrolling down, looking at my sheet here. Mm-hmm. That panel will be Sunday, November 15th at 6 p.m. And folks will be able to hear from the people who were there at the 1972 Black National Convention that was held in Gary. And we're pretty excited about that. And we think folks will be able to watch the film. Once again, you can order the film, watch it at any time, and then come back on November 15th at 6 o'clock and hear from the people who were there.
We're talking with Karen Towing, who is the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival, coming up beginning November 10th, and it'll be all online. And Karen, I know in particular that you always try to have some interesting roundtable and panel discussions that focus in on certain topics. And this time around, because it's the 10th annual event, that you're going to spend time discussing and maybe even some debates may come up about topics like cinematographers as well as Black women. Tell us about those two sessions coming up.
Yeah, we do have two Academy-nominated Black cinematographers who are going to talk about what it's like to be on inside of the industry, inside Hollywood. That'll feature Eric Bronco, who was the cinematographer that is on a pretty popular film now on Netflix called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a play on the name, which is, you know, just really kind of burning up Netflix and incredibly popular film. And Hans Charles, who was the cinematographer on Ava DuVernay's film 13. And they'll be talking about, you know, get these two guys together, and of course they want to talk about the equipment and the technology, but they'll also be talking about their favorite cinematographers and directors. And that should be a pretty lively conversation, and that's going to happen on, I think that's on Thursday. This is a big schedule, so I have to sort of scroll around.
Well, I don't blame you for looking it up.
And get the details for all of our panels. And then we'll have a panel on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock that features women directors, both regional and national directors of film and television. And those conversations, again, will, you know, give you an inside look at what it's like, not only for Black people in Hollywood and independent media and television, but also women who face, you know, additional challenges breaking into an industry and being part of an industry that is very, very male dominated. We also have another, I'm excited about a panel of Black animators. These are folks that are behind some of your favorite animated series, and in these COVID times, animators are a hot commodity. You know, with you know, sheltering in place and all of those things, we're finding that a lot more animation is coming online, and animators are in demand. And so it's really exciting to see these young Black animators really come into their own, and we're pretty excited about that too. Also, you know, we're super excited to have producer and director and writer Bill Duke is going to be joining us on Sunday afternoon. That would be November 15th for a panel discussion with young filmmakers. So this will be sort of a generational conversation. Bill Duke is a veteran in the industry who's done several films, movies, and television, who will be also joined by some of the new directors that are coming on board, writers and directors, and that's Sunday afternoon. So our panels will be rich with dialogue and, like you said, maybe a little controversy, but they'll give folks a really good look at the industry from a Black perspective.
Now, closing night is coming up on November 20th, and that's going to be a very special night as well, too, with some special awards, I understand.
Yes, we will. Every year, we give out an award for someone who's made an impact in Gary through their body of work and their relationship to the community, and that is called the GIDFF Impact Award. I'm not going to tell you who's going to get it. We're going to reveal that on closing night, and then we also do the Kelechukwu Birinfre Vanguard Award, and that's given to an artist whose work is really about purpose and about social justice and about the creative process that we know is in Gary. Okay, Gary is the home of some really, really talented folks, and the Kelechukwu Birinfre Award celebrates that talent.
Now, Karen, you mentioned at the start of our conversation that there were about 1,200 or plus of entries that came in this year for this 10th annual. Yes, you have to catch your breath when you talk those numbers. Ooh. To be sure. Yes, for this year's for the 10th annual Gary International Black Film Festival, what kind of other work that had to be done here behind the scenes to get ready for the event that gets underway on November 10th?
Right. Yeah. So we had entries from around the world, and we had about 60 people from across the country viewing those films and rating those films and thinking about whether or not those films would represent, you know, the best and the brightest in independent filmmaking. And that took us several months to get through all of those films. And this year we'll have, over the course of the 10 days, we'll have just under 60 films. So we took the 1,300 entries and narrowed them down to 60. And folks will not only be able to watch the film, but you'll also be able to check in and talk to some of the filmmakers about their work as well.
That's great to hear. Once again, what's that website address so people can take a look at the schedule, make note of it, print it off if they need to do so, and where they can get their tickets as well, the passes for the films coming up?
You can get tickets and passes at GaryBlackFilmFest.org.
Well, Karen, thank you very much for all the great information. We're looking forward to this 10th annual Gary International Black Film Festival. And thank you, Karen Toing, for telling us all about it. And the best of luck to you and everybody involved in the festival this year.
Thanks, Chris. And we'll see you online at the Gary International Black Film Festival.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, we have a Veterans Day special program.